train of thought where we were talking about Euclideanizing gravity. And I've written down this schematic representation of a partition function at a finite temperature. And so I mentioned that to Euclideanize, you have to send T to I tau. And because of the signature I've chosen, you'll also have to flip the sign of the metric. So this Hamiltonian here would notionally be an integral of a Hamiltonian density over space. And I can, if my time is periodic, I could also add in an integral d tau and divide by the length of the time interval. And so, sorry, if I do 1 over beta. No, that's right. So in this case, what I've really got, if you analytically continue the action, I end up with H being 1 over beta times a Euclidean action. So this thing here, this H over T, is simply the Euclidean action, finite temperature. So we had derived our Einstein-Hilbert action. So you might be tempted to simply say, that our Euclidean action is just the integral of the curvature over the manifold. But as I hinted yesterday, this is not necessarily the full story. So let's look at this in the context of Schwarzschild. So if I send T goes to I tau and flip the sign of the metric, then that's what I get, not surprisingly. You just write down the Schwarzschild metric with all pluses. So what happens now at r equals 2gm? So r equal 2gm was the event horizon in the Lorentzian black hole, and it was a coordinate singularity. It wasn't a physical singularity. Now, from the Euclidean point of view, if we try to go to r less than 2gm, we flip from a Euclidean plus, 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 plus metric to something different. It's minus, minus, plus, plus. So that is not a Euclidean solution. So this tells us that r equals 2gm is a boundary of our Euclidean space. So if this surface is non-singular in the Lorentzian section, we really want it to be non-singular here in the Euclidean side. So what we'll do is look a bit more closely at R equals 2 GM. So let's approach 2 GM. Let's go to somewhere near R minus 2 GM. So in practice, what that means is I'm substituting in this full form R equals 2 GM, and I'm just looking, if I have a factor of R minus 2 GM, then I'm writing that explicitly out. So I'm taking this to leading order in the difference between R and 2 GM. So there are higher order terms. This is not an exact metric. So if you notice here, if I look at this part, I could always shift the origin, right, of R. So here I've got something that looks like d rho squared on rho. And I can write this term as a total derivative by simply taking a new coordinate, which is proportional to the square root of R minus 2 gm. So I redefine my radial coordinate. So you can see that this square root here is going to bring that to 1 over r minus 2 gm. This root 2 gm here will provide that 2 gm there. And the factor of 2 takes account of the half you get when you take the derivative of root r minus 2 gm. So this new coordinate we'll take the radial part of the metric simply to d rho squared. So what I get is a d rho squared and then if I look here at d tau squared, well, r minus 2 gm is just rho squared over 8 gm. And then there's another 2 gm there, which takes it to 16 g squared m squared. So my d tau squared is just proportional to rho squared. Since I put an equal sign, I probably should put plus dot, dot, dot. So this ought to be, the tau rho part of this ought to look familiar, because this is just like if I write r squared in polar coordinates, then my metric is just d rho squared plus rho squared d theta squared. And there's nothing singular about the origin on the plane. The only thing that's singular is the coordinate system. So this tells us that if we make tau periodic, so we know that tau over 4 gm has to have 2 pi periodicity. So that tells us the periodicity of tau has to be 8 pi gm. Then this metric here is non-singular as r goes to 2 gm. So we've just looked at this Euclidean metric. We've decided that because it's non-singular as a black hole at r equals 2 gm, it ought to be non-singular when you analytically continue. However, we recognize it has to be a boundary. Otherwise, the Euclidean metric would, well, wouldn't be Euclidean anymore. And so we simply look, look at what happens near 2 gm. And find that we are led to making our Euclidean time periodic and also finding out what the periodicity is. So if I sketch now, what if I sort of stop focusing in at 2 gm and think about what happens to the metric more generally, I know that a very large r, so I'll suppress the theta phi. At very large r, this factor 1 minus 2 gm on r just goes to 1. So what you have is like a periodic d tau and a simple dr. And that is the metric on a cylinder. Then as you move towards r equals 2 gm, the size of the tau circles decreases. So this starts to curve inwards, and then eventually rounds smoothly off at 2 gm. So this is 2 gm. This coordinate here is the time coordinate, and this coordinate here is r or rho or whatever, whichever, so a radial coordinate. So this is sometimes called the black hole cigar. Since that's what it looks like. And it has periodicity 8 pi gm, which is r beta. So this is telling us that the black hole is actually associated with a finite temperature. So T is 1 over beta. So it's inversely proportional to the mass. And if you, I should get my constants in, if you reinstate your constants, that's what you get. So because this Euclidean section is periodic, if you try and put any quantum fields on the background of a black hole, they're going to behave as if they're at a temperature T. So this is a somewhat quicker way of computing the temperature of a black hole, although it does rely on certain amounts, you know, using certain formalisms when they're strictly not quite true, but they just seem to work. And so you, because you verify this independently, you trust this method. And in practice, if you want to compute a temperature of a black hole type of metric quickly, this is what you do. You simply go near the horizon, you expand out, there's always something looking like this, and you simply look at whatever this factor is here to compute the temperature. Mm-hmm. Just mainly the setup for formalism, this idea of, I mean, you know, if Euclidean quantum gravity actually worked, there wouldn't be all this hoopla about quantizing gravity, right? The problem is that when you compute the action, you know, that it's actually unbounded below. So, you know, there's lots of mathematical problems, you know, when you actually, if you wanted to sort of say this is absolutely true. But in practice, this idea of writing, which, you know, I haven't written it yet because I want to do some other thing first, but in practice, sort of having this notion of having manifolds, you know, which have certain characteristics, for example, periodicity at a certain temperature or with certain charges, and the idea that it's dominated by stationary points of your action, so you've got this semi-classical approach, does work. It does make sense. So I think the caveat is just use it as a tool, but be a little cautious about, you know, taking the underlying formalism too serious. You know, well, that's my own. I just use it as a tool and don't worry too much about the rest of it. So you had a question, sorry.
When we use Euclidean language, basically some sort of a coordinate transformation or redefinition.
Well, it's a rotation. It's not really a coordinate transformation because coordinate transformations, our manifold is real, at least, you know, what we perceive it to be. Mm-hmm. Our metric is real. It's a real function on our manifold. So our coordinate transformations are only ever sort of differentiable normal functions. So by rotating, by look rotating, they're actually going outside of normal, you know, our usual sort of physical setup. But it does work and it's very useful.
And that led us to this result on the temperature, the periodicity.
Yes. Yeah.
Do you think there's a good physical way to think about why we should get this result on the temperature?
Well, I think what I was saying, I mean, from the Euclidean perspective, so what I was saying yesterday was that reminding you about Malcolm Perry's talk about loss of information, and so sort of sketching about how one would do this properly is you wouldn't even think about the Euclidean section, so I sketched this last time, where you have a black hole forming, you've got your event horizon, and the idea being that on the past, you can
form a basis of, you know, a basis of states for your field theory, and you have to do that also on the future. But as you see, if you look at the future, you've actually got two components, two null surfaces forming your future. So essentially, your Hilbert space here has to sort of have an overlap with both of these, which means that the transformation between this one and this one is non-trivial. So your vacuum here is not a vacuum here. That doesn't mean it's thermal necessarily. You have to go through the sweat of actually doing it to see that. But that's the sort of field theory reason. It's like saying that what you mean by positive frequency here changes when you go through a time-dependent or some time-dependent part of space-time, and it certainly changes when you've got horizons. So what you mean by a vacuum is changing. So, I mean, there's the usual physical picture that's quoted is that you have pair production somewhere near the event horizon. Sometimes, you know, so your vacuum has always got these virtual loops, and sometimes one of these escapes and one falls in. So that's the other way of visualizing it. And it is simply saying that what you mean by positive energy or positive frequency out here in the past is not the same. So there's various different ways, you know, of thinking about it depending on how you visualize what's going on.
Does black hole temperature have anything to do with the surface gravity?
Yes, but I haven't talked about surface gravity yet. So the surface gravity is, you can think of these event horizons in some way as being a bit like soap bubbles, in that the event horizon wants to be to sort of be as small as it possibly can while still supporting the mass inside it. And so this is why, in four dimensions at least, we find that event horizons are spherical, because that's like your minimum minimum surface area enclosing a certain volume. And you can compute the surface gravity of the black hole, which is calculated from, you know, an event horizon is a null surface, which you can see from here. And so you can look at the geodesics forming up that null surface and actually sort of find out properties about their divergence and so on. So the surface gravity is really a bit like the surface tension of a soap bubble. And so, yes, it is related to the temperature. Mm-hmm.
This temperature is measured by which
temperature?
Is that obvious from
the calculation,
or is that just
in this island? I'm not sure it is obvious, actually. But,
does this only work if your space time is not compatible?
No, it works in a whole range of situations. You find that horizons of all sorts have temperatures. So, if another example of a horizon is if you're in the sitter space, so the sitter space has effective horizons. If I draw a causal diagram of the sitter space, it's like a lower half plane, and you get horizons simply because as you go off to infinity, there's a boundary of what you can see, and so the sitter space has an effective temperature as well. An accelerating observer has an effective temperature. So this is in the case of, so with the sitter space, once again you've got a horizon, and you can do the same process. If you've got out of the sitter space, then you've got, essentially turn that the other way around, you've actually got a boundary on the space-time, but you put the black hole inside, and again you can use this to compute its temperature. So this works in a, you know, in a wide range of situations that you're likely to meet. Well, in that case, I suppose it's a bit nuddier, isn't it? Which is it, I suppose. I guess it's an observer who is at rest in that particular space-time. So here, you know, here you're thinking of somebody who's not accelerating. Yeah.
So, if you like the point, if you draw like the cigar as a plane, right, which is how you make it non-singular, you end up with rho equals zero being the center of the plane.
Mm-hmm.
So rho equals zero corresponds to the event horizon.
Yes.
Okay. So essentially, you've gotten rid of the singularity by cutting out everything inside the event horizon.
Yes. Yeah, so sitting over here at r equals 2 gm is of course the two sphere.
Yeah. I just suppressed it because it wasn't doing anything that you didn't expect. So in this case, we have our Euclidean description of Schwarzschild, and so we know that we have some solution at finite temperature. But I could also think about flat space at finite temperature. So flat space at finite temperature would just be the cylinder, right? Well, this would just be tau. So you take r cubed and just simply add on a little circle for tau. So any construction that I was talking about, computing a partition function, any sort of Euclidean quantum gravity type of construction ought to be able to distinguish between this solution and this solution. So there ought, you know, there should be a difference between these two, because they're clearly different physical solutions. But the problem is that for both flat space and Euclidean Schwarzschild, R vanishes. So if we simply take our Euclidean action to be the integral of the Ricci scalar, we're in trouble, because it's going to give the same answer for these two space-times or spaces, whatever. So what's going on here? We know there's a difference, because we can see one is absolutely flat and one isn't, one is curved, but the curvature in this sense is not Ricci curvature, it's simply Riemann curvature, which is not going to show up in that Euclidean action. We don't particularly want to add additional sort of higher order curvature terms sitting here, like R mu nu lambda tau squared or something, because we don't do that for our equations of motion. This would actually change the gravitational equations of motion. So we'd really like to do something that isn't too dramatic. And the clue lies in what happens when you vary that Euclidean action. Let me just make sure I get my signs right here. So remember when we varied this R? We had these second order terms in our Riemann, in our Ricci. Sorry, in the derivative of our variation of the metric. So unlike normal field theories, where the kinetic part of the action is just a first order derivative of your field, in Einstein gravity, the Ricci scalar contains second order derivatives of the metric, which is the field that you're varying. And therefore, when we did our Euler-Lagrange variation of the action, we had to assume that not only G, but the normal derivative of G vanished on the boundary. So that's a much stronger assumption, because it's making a statement about G in the neighborhood of the boundary. And somehow you feel you shouldn't be doing that for a variational principle. So this is a clue that's telling us that perhaps in the case of gravity, we need to modify our action with some sort of boundary term, so that when we do a full variation, this normal derivative will be cancelled off by a variation on the boundary. Now, when this boundary term was first cooked up, it was much more in the context of trying to make this Euclidean picture hold. So it was perhaps appeared to be more formal, something that was mathematical, which was making Euler-Lagrange work and also making this Euclidean approach work. But nowadays, it's actually very useful to have some sort of boundary action because we would like, we find ourselves in situations, particularly when we have extra dimensions, where we want to have a space-time with a boundary, and we maybe want to think of that boundary as being something physical. So quite often in string theory, you actually do put boundaries on your space-time, and these do represent some particular object. And so you would like, from a gravitational energy point of view, to have some corresponding description of the boundary as a physical object. And another example of where maybe not exactly a boundary, but the same sort of formalism crops up, is that if you want to imagine, for example, say there's a supernova or something, and you suddenly get a shock wave of matter being ejected out from a particular source, this you could think of as being, very roughly speaking, some sort of shell of matter of some form, which, you know, may be expanding outwards, but it is something which is effectively two-dimensional from our perspective. So it's something that looks like you would like to be able to approximate it by some thin shell, in which case, whilst it's not exactly a boundary, it is something which is of infinitesimal thickness, and you could imagine your space-time there as being, you know, two parts with this boundary where the two boundaries are glued together. So that's another example, and in fact, this is the physical example where the formalism I'm about to start deriving, this is where it was first brought in to general relativity. Yep.
Don't work anymore.
A big shell theorem.
We said if you're inside a shell of mass, then you don't even feel like there's no, you don't feel any field.
Yes, but that's a spherically symmetric shell.
Right.
I'm not talking about spherically.
Even not spherically symmetric.
Well, but in terms of the Newtonian theory, it's usually if you have spherical symmetry, and inside there you have no gravitational field.
But even if it's not.
But in this case, we're sitting in the context of general relativity, so we've left, you know, we've kind of left Newton behind. We know general relativity is a, you know, highly non-linear, fully coupled theory, and as you will see, you know, if for a general shell, there's no guarantee whatsoever what the manifold will be on either side. Okay. So you can, in certain special circumstances, solve for the space away from the shell on each side. So I hope you get into that next week. But in general, there's, you know, you're seeing blobs. So there's no. But the fact, even the fact that, you know, you, as I said, you have this highly nonlinear coupled theory of gravity to make something infinitesimally thin.
Means from a physical point of view, you're producing a delta function, or what you would like to call a delta function, in your energy momentum tensor. But a delta function, if you think about that from a nonlinear point of view, the risk that you take in producing a delta function is that when you try and find things gravitationally, you're going to get squares of delta functions, and the whole thing's just going to be hopelessly singular. And the miracle is that provided you've just got one extra dimension, you can actually do it. So you can take a sensible zero thickness limit. And that zero thickness limit also corresponds to exactly the same formalism that you use when you've got a boundary on your space-time. So I'm going to, this is sort of the topic of basically the rest of the week, because there's only today and tomorrow, there's lectures. So the mathematics behind this is called Gauss-Kadatze. And it is essentially how to describe submanifolds in your space, higher dimensional manifold. So the idea here, I'm going to be doing it mostly in the context of something which is just a hypersurface, something of one dimension down. But I'll try and indicate from time to time how it generalizes if you have more than one additional direction. So here's some submanifold, sigma. It's got some normal, or possibly a set of normals. So the number of linearly independent normal vectors is called the codimension of sigma. So for example, in our universe, we could imagine actually three different sorts of submanifold that make physical sense. So we could have what's known as a wall, domain wall, in which we have a membrane, which is 2 plus 1 dimensional, and that's codimension 1. So just to have as a visualization, so a codimension 1 is a wall, sometimes called a domain wall. Codimension 2 is a string. And actually, we can have codimension 3, although we don't think about it that way, is just a point particle. So usually a useful way when you're doing this is to carry along a picture of one of these submanifolds. And so generally, if you're dealing with something which is codimension 1, imagine it as one of these domain walls. If you're dealing with something with higher codimension, sort of think about it. Usually a string is sort of a good analogy, because the string is something which does have a length, some sort of extension in space. But it also has more than one normal direction. So just to have a, so I'm going to just say that the dimensions of my various objects, sigma has dimension d, the manifold has dimension n, so codimension is n minus d. So then you can also think of having coordinates on your submanifold. It's a manifold in its own right, so it has coordinates. So the coordinates, they're normal, which means that they annihilate all of these coordinate functions. That's simply saying that, you know, the sigmas lie perpendicular to n. So if I wrote this out, it would look like this in terms of the usual kind of index notation. Our manifold here, sigma, in terms of my higher dimensional coordinates, is given by a surface which is a function of the internal coordinates. And so these are tangent vectors to sigma, which lie in the tangent space in M, and they're normal to the normal vectors. So that's sort of all just making obvious statements. So whenever I'm using more than one codimension, I'm just going to actually be assuming that I've taken an orthonormal basis of this perpendicular space. So the purpose of Gauss-Kadatze, at least from our perspective, what it does for us is it's going to split our curvature, our Riemann or Ricci tensor, into things which are sort of parallel to the submanifold and things which are perpendicular to the submanifold. And in looking at things which represent sort of perpendicular information, we're going to find something which makes sense to use for our boundary term. So, some definitions. So here I'm going to be using physicist notation in the sense of indices sort of standing in for a tensorial objects. Another way this formalism is useful, I'm sorry, because I was giving you a little list of things it was useful for, is if you want to think of doing gravity as a dynamical theory, then you want to split yourself up into spatial surfaces which evolve dynamically in time. That's what numerical relativists do. And in that case, what you're doing is you're slicing your space through with a time coordinate. So your normal here would be like d by dt. And in this case, this is sort of taking this is very useful as a way of making GR into something that's more of a sort of standard time evolution, a dynamical theory. So H it's called the first fundamental form in terms of this Gauss-Kadatze nomenclature, but it's just the metric on sigma. It's taking your higher dimensional manifolds metric and simply projecting out the bits that are normal. So if I contract this H with one of the n's, I'm simply going to, if I put in n on this side, I would get n here, and then I would get minus n from this sum, so I get 0. So if you put anything normal to H, it just gives you zero. H, of course, still lives in the tangent bundle of M, because this is, these are M indices. So it's assuming, or it's taking sigma to really be something which is dependent on the manifold. Sigma is just inheriting all its structure from M. On the other hand, we could also think of sigma in its own right, just as the manifold. Yep.
Well, if you go through, if the minus sign is to make sure that the projection, it is a projection.
So all you have to do is to go through a contract with a normal vector, and you'll see that if the normal vector is space-like, n squared is minus 1. If the normal vector is time-like, n squared is plus 1. So you need to change the sign depending on whether it's space-like or time-like. So if you were in the normal Euclidean plus 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 space, you would always be taking minus nn, right? So you'd be having your projection operator being subtracting off the, you know, the normal bits. But we're in a Lorentzian metric, so we have to flip signs and we have to put the right sign given the conventions. So I'm back in a Lorentzian metric, plus minus minus minus. So, and the reason I'm doing this specifically for Lorentzian metric is I want to use this whole setup in a Lorentzian setup next week, as well as using it tomorrow for calculating our Euclidean actions. So as long as you're careful, make sure you know that you're doing the right thing. It's not a problem, but it does mean you have to put in the right signs. So we can, as I was saying, sigma is a manifold in its own right, and so we can actually project vectors in our tangent bundle of M into vectors in our tangent plane of sigma itself. So in this case, it's actually, I guess, TP star. This is less commonly done, I guess, in the maths, but I did want to do it because from string, what string theory tends to do is it's actually thinking of the submanifold sigma as being the fundamental object, so that, in fact, stuff that lives on sigma is really where all the action is. And you, it's sort of, formally at least, splits off this this tie between the higher dimensional manifold and the lower dimensional submanifold. And so these coordinates here then just become fields living on the submanifold. So although in practice anything that we're going to be doing is going to be very much thinking of this as being the real object and this as being something which lives in it, that doesn't have to be that way. However, Gauss-Kadazy is that way. So that's the first fundamental form. So to get the second fundamental form, we simply take a derivative of our normal and then make sure that we've projected out any orthogonal parts of it. So what this actually does, this is like a derivative of a first derivative of a metric. This is telling us how our submanifold curves into the manifold. So if I kind of sketch a little, some piece of your, yeah? Symmetrized. Well, if you do it here, it induces a symmetry there. So you're only doing it there, but these are being summed over. So you'll find it induces one there as well. So if I have this is sort of focusing in on some piece of sigma, what you see is if these are my normals, you can actually see that the normals, as I move along, this is taking a parallel derivative here. As I move parallel to sigma, my normal actually does change. So you can see here that as I sweep along this coordinate, my normal vector is changing. And the amount by which it's changing does actually lie parallel to the original surface. So if I were to think of this from putting my indices in the intrinsic part, another useful alternative way of writing the extrinsic curvature, is as a submanifold derivative of this projection operator here. So I just want to wrap up with an example, because this all just sort of looks, you know, like it's not sort of necessarily easy to see how it's actually working. So what I want to do is look at the cylinder in R cubed. So here, this is my submanifold. It's just a cylinder aligned with the z-axis. So I'm in Cartesian coordinates, completely Euclidean. My normal vector is just a radial vector in the xy plane. So it has components cos theta, sine theta in the xy plane. In this case, I'm in a completely Euclidean space, so I subtract off the normals. And I sort of very rapidly see that Cartesians are not necessarily a good move here. So instead, if I go into polar coordinates, the reason Cartesians are not brilliant coordinates here is they're clearly not aligned with my submanifold. Okay? So on the xy plane, my circle is moving through different values of x and y. Whereas if I go to polar coordinates, my cylinder is simply lying at r equals a. So everything, my coordinates are then aligned with my surface. Obviously, not all objects are so cooperative, but at least this one is. So in polars, where we've got that KAB was equal to the covariant derivative of the normal. And if I've aligned myself with the coordinate system, I'm simply just going to get minus gamma RAB. And therefore, K theta theta is R, which is A. So in terms of intrinsic coordinates, my metric is just one in the z direction, dz squared. It's a squared going round, some constant. And my extrinsic curvature has only one non-zero component, which is the theta-theta component, and that's a. And so what this is telling you is that this cylinder, when viewed as a submanifold of r cubed, actually has some bending, right? There's some extrinsic curvature. So when you first come across curvature of manifolds, you're told that the cylinder is flat, which of course always seems rather counterintuitive. But what our intuition is telling us when we think of a cylinder as being curved, we are thinking of it as being curved as an embedding in the higher dimensional manifold, R cubed. And so this extrinsic curvature is taking, is sort of encapsulating and formalizing that intuition of curvature. So that's what the extrinsic curvature is doing. It's formalizing what are sort of what we often think of as being curvature. Okay? So I'll stop there.